All right, hello everybody. You're here to see Peter Yates and Dean Marcus, and with apologies from Susie Amos. They together are part of the working group, the industry working group on cyber risk, and today they're presenting ensuring cyber risk. Peter is an associate director at Ernst & Young. Dean, he works alongside me, actually, as an actuary at Taylor Fry, and Susie, who's unable to be with us today, is a principal at Finity. So, with ensuring cyber risks, I introduce to you Peter Yates and Dean Marcus.
Thanks very much. So this is a work in progress. There's a paper that we were hoping to have ready for this conference, and probably be ready for the next conference. That's what we keep telling ourselves. Okay, so this working group is focused on specifically on cyber insurance. So cyber insurance for general insurers. The question is, why does anyone care about it? Why is it now the right time to be thinking about cyber insurance as a general insurer? A couple of reasons. So in the US, cyber insurance has been a very rapidly growing product, particularly over the last sort of 5 years, driven, as we'll see, by some very specific American trends. But there are a couple of triggers in Australia that we think over the next couple of years are likely to start driving very high growth in Australia, albeit off a very low premium base at the moment. But we're expecting it to see a lot of development, both premium growth, development in the product and the services around it. So we're going to talk a bit about the environment, so the environment in the world around the world, the environment in Australia. Then we're going to think about the product itself, the pricing, the thought process behind that. Claims obviously come out of all of that, and reserving as actuaries, a subject dear to our heart. After that, I'm going to touch on aggregation and scenarios, and then finally think a little bit about the future. So, the environment. So, what we're looking at here is, if we look at this diagram here, if I'm a general insurance company, over on the left-hand side, there are a couple of ways in which cyber risks can impact my business. The first one is operational risk. So, cyber attack disrupts the operation of my business. It stops me selling premium. It stops me handling claims. It leads to poor publicity. So that's a cyber threat that's, shall I say, fairly generic to other businesses. So, and as a working group, given limited time and resources, we've chosen not to focus on that because there's a lot of material out there. What we've chosen to focus on are the bottom two items. So the impact that cyber threats have on pure cyber insurance policies, so cyber insurance on the sticker, and the threat that cyber perils have on all of the other policies that general insurers are currently writing. So we'll come and talk about that a little bit later. So a bit of background. So cyber threats have been in the media a lot. You know, increasingly high media profile. The US, probably the biggest, most well-known case there was the Target breach of customer data, penetrated through a third-party contractor. Hillary Clinton's email server has obviously been in the news a lot recently. The disruption to the Australian census led to a lot of pain, a lot of embarrassment. It's not clear whether it was a data breach or whether it was intentional, whether it was some misconfigured technology. And finally, the Australian Red Cross Blood Service. I don't know how many of you are blood donors, but I got an email a couple of weeks ago saying your data may have been, as a blood donor, may have been released into the wild. So in response to all these kind of events, general insurers have developed cyber insurance products. The product's quite focused on data breaches, and we'll see why in a second. It incorporates some interesting services to help insureds respond to data breaches, respond to cyber incidents. A little bit like the old roadside assistance for motor insurers. And as we'll see, it covers many gaps that exist in relation to the existing suite of products. In terms of from an insured's point of view, where this fits in, so they've done all their sort of threat modelling, their threat planning, and figured out who they think might attack them, why, how they might be vulnerable. They've put in place countermeasures. They've strengthened their defences. They've put in place detection capabilities. But increasingly, insureds are coming to accept that actually it's very difficult to be impervious to cyber attacks. We've seen the US department that looks after classified security clearances breach, lose all their records. We've seen Edward Snowden walk out of the NSA with a lot of embarrassing information. So hopefully companies are now reaching the point where they're starting to kind of think about it more from an ERM point of view, saying, okay, what kind of protection do I need? How much does it cost? What's the most cost-effective way of doing this? And obviously there's the response planning part of it all. As a result of this, what we're seeing globally is premium volume of about $2.5 billion of pure cyber insurance. It's not an awful lot, but it's been growing extremely rapidly and expected to grow extremely rapidly over the next decade. Now, at the moment, most of that premium, well in excess of 90%, is in the US. And as we'll see in a second, most of it's concentrated on large corporates. So there's a lot of space for that premium to keep on growing, both growing in the US, but also off an extremely small base growing outside the US. The reason why we're in the situation we're talking about, this very, very US-based product, and where the US has been unique up till now, is that the US has got mandatory data breach notification requirements. So the first key piece of this was the HIPAA 1998 legislation around health insurance records. It didn't come into force until 2003, and in 2003, California also put in place state regulations. So in the health sector, you've got federal regulations, and then you've got this layer across California that's more broad. And what this means is if you've lost customer personal information, you have to tell the customers. And there are a lot of consequences that follow from this. Just contacting millions of customers is an expensive exercise, let alone getting the lawyers in, let alone speaking to the regulators, any fines and penalties that may ensue. In the US, directors and officers litigation has been a feature as well. So what we've seen, so that was the federal and that was California. Over the next sort of 5 years, that spread across 47 states. So insureds have to contend with state-by-state regulations. A lot of them are modelled in California, but there will be local differences as well. So it becomes a bit of a mosaic. We've now seen the Europeans pass similar legislation. It doesn't come into force until May 2018, but the expectation in Europe is that they're going to see very, very rapid growth in cyber insurance premiums in the run-up to May 2018 because they've had their fair share of data breaches, very high-profile ones. But this is going to have more teeth. It's going to be mandated, and insureds are more likely to seek cyber insurance as a result. Mentioned before, up to now in the US, purchases have largely been by large corporates. Even there, less than a third of them have got cyber insurance at the moment. Amongst small, medium enterprises, very, very low rate of penetration at the moment. And, obviously huge, huge opportunity for growth just within the US. Looking at Australia, there are a lot of cyber products out there at the moment. The premium volumes are fairly low, sort of 20 million or less. They're not standardised. The terms and conditions, the service offerings behind them, they're different between all of the different products. So as a potential insured, there's a lot to work through with your broker to try and figure out what do you need, how much you need, what services do you need to sit alongside it. And we'll touch on that a little bit later. So Why is cyber insurance most likely coming to Australia in a much larger way? There's been privacy legislation in place since 1998. But last year, and in fact, there's been mandatory data breach notification in two places. So once in the credit card space, so contractually with your credit card processing provider, you will have obligations with them. But also the notification of serious data breach legislation has been presented for an exposure draft. It's currently scheduled to go to federal parliament later this year. It's not much later this year, so it may well be next year. But there appears to be sort of very widespread support for it going into law, so it's expected to pass into law. Now, what we've seen elsewhere is a couple of years of grace period before the clauses come into effect, so there's a chance for everyone to get up to speed. But it appears to be coming, and it will make a very, very big change in terms of data breach notification and all of the consequences that follow on from that for corporates. Okay, so that's the background. That's why we're here. That's why we have a working group talking about cyber insurance, thinking about cyber insurance. So, you know, as actuaries, you know, what's our role? How do we get involved? I think there's a whole lot of ways. It's not the stable, mature class of business. It doesn't have everything you'll want. It doesn't have the certainty you might be looking for. It's green fields. But we'll talk through some key elements of that. So first of all, talking about product. So why is cyber insurance a thing? Essentially there are a couple of elements to this. Cyber insurance covers third party damages. So the card holders whose credit card information you lost, for example, PCI fines, that sort of thing, those are covered. In terms of heads of damage, in terms of peril, there's not a requirement for a physical loss to occur. So some other policies might require a physical loss and therefore not be triggered. So you can see there's a range of other covers that may or may not respond depending on the specific terms. Cyber could be included in some of these as a rider or as an extension. But there's a broad series of gaps that cyber is trying to cover, for better or for worse. In terms of pricing, the starting point of pricing is typically looking at the industry that the insured is in. And this boils down to the fact that there is very poor data at the moment on the characteristics of insureds. So what you really want to know is how much personal information they've got, how much stuff they've got in their systems that cyber attackers would like to have, and how well they protect it. In practice, industry type often serves as a starting proxy for how much personal information they have and how attractive it's likely to be. So as an example, credit card information, obviously very attractive because you can turn it into cash fairly easily. Health information is very attractive because while you can turn around and get a new credit card and cancel the old one with the bank, you can't change your health information very easily. So you're kind of stuck with it. You're kind of stuck with the consequences of that data breach. So that's the kind of stuff that leads to different levels of exposure and attractiveness. So, I mean, there are also political elements and whether the company's been controversial, that sort of thing. Then on the protection side, you've got the sort of usual range of things around culture, around corporate attitudes to risk, outdated IT infrastructure. You've got an IT layer. So they're not well-established standards for saying how robust is your IT security. So it's an area that's sort of under development. There are a lot of competing standards, but they're not well aligned to what an insurer is looking for, to be honest. Okay. Dean's now going to talk about something near and dear to actuaries' hearts.
So on the back of Peter's discussion about pricing, insurers would then have to question, where does the data come from? So there's actually quite a lot of data available, but it's very much focused on IT security. So for example, there are websites that track live DDoS attacks, and this image at the bottom is one of them. It's a very small part of it, where you can see a map of the world and you can actually see packages that represent DDoS attacks and where they're coming from and where they're going to. So there are also some cybersecurity surveys out there, and these are run by management consultants, and they go to many different industries and companies, and they ask them about the measures that they have in place. But all of this data is not very useful from an insurer's perspective because it doesn't give you details about paid losses that are relevant if you're about to offer coverage. But there are some surveys that are actually quite useful, and these come from the US, and they typically focus on around a few dozen large companies where they go to the companies and they ask them about recent cyber breaches that they've had, and then they give them information. So this information contains things like, how did they identify the breach? So what was the method that they identified it? Was it internal who found it? Was it a virus recognition? And what's the delay from when the breach actually occurred to when it was found? So maybe it was sitting around there for a long time. Another thing that's detailed in these surveys is the attacks themselves. So the method of the attack, maybe it was an internal person who compromised the data, or maybe it was a hacker in some particular way. And these surveys are split by industry in quite a useful way. Now, as Peter mentioned, the mandatory breach notification, if it comes into effect, that will result in a big benefit for data because there'll be a lot more available. But, as Peter also mentioned, it will also increase the cost very much. So it will increase the cost of reporting and regulation, and there'll just be more claims to pay out because people will be more aware of it. Now, there are some general caveats to do with the data available. And the first one is that the events that are listed in these surveys are the actual breaches. So they're asking the companies themselves, what are the breaches? What were the attacks? As opposed to asking an insurance company, what did you pay out? So as a result of this, it doesn't cover all perils because you don't find out about investigation costs that the insurers incurred in trying to prove causality, which is often necessary. There's also not much information about legal costs for the insurers. Now, the third caveat is, how useful is the historical data? So the landscape is changing every day. There are new threats, new viruses, new methods of hacking. Software itself is changing so that there are new vulnerabilities. If you know the average cost per breach over the last 5 years, it may have nothing to do with the events that are about to occur. And finally, very few breaches are actually reported. And this is before mandatory reporting comes in. So there are some more kind of technical biases that are in these, I should have mentioned that there's an appendix to this that has a few of these surveys listed in them and details of what they contain. So there are some more technical biases in these surveys, which is also in the appendix, because there are some obvious deficiencies in the surveys. So for example, the companies that are actually willing to respond, they might be the ones that have fewer data breaches, or the ones that have lots of data breaches might not be willing to respond. Also, they might be very reluctant to divulge their actual information, so they might give false information. There are no real checks and balances on that. And another important bias to keep in mind is that these surveys don't contain, so they'll list all of the breaches for a company or for an industry, but they don't contain details about the cybersecurity measures that the different industries have in place. So it might be that one industry has appears to have very high risk, but that could just be due to a correlation of them not having much security in general. So there are some other biases that are in the appendix. All right, now, bit of a chat about claims. So here we've got a rough timeline of a claim. So in the first few days, the company will notify the insurer and the insurer will send a response team that includes IT forensics to identify and help to stabilize the breach. Then in the first week, the IT specialist will try to stop the breach and secure the systems. Legal advice will be sought and will consider the nature and the extent of the losses. And a crisis management plan will be put in place, or created maybe in the first week. Then in the first month, there's a big PR effort to restore the reputation of the company. The insurance There are insurance investigation and loss adjusters are involved, and a full rectification plan should be in place by then. The final stages, which is maybe 3 to 6 months, is really focused on restoring systems, restoring reputation, and finalizing the claims. So a few notes on claims handling. The first thing to note is that the insurers are going to have to respond very quickly, and this is analogous to kidnap and ransom policies. And this is in order to contain and assess the losses as soon as possible. Another thing to note is that there will be a very strong reliance on third-party support for crisis mitigation, IT forensics, and legal. And this leads to probably the biggest question mark at the moment around claims handling, which is that it's quite unclear how the model is going to scale for smaller businesses and smaller claims. Because at the moment, if you need to prove causality, it takes a lot of investigation effort and a lot of cost for the insurer. And if the policy is very small or the claim is very small, this cost of investigation completely swamps the other costs. Now, the companies that are insured, they expect to be covered. They've bought this policy. They expect to be covered when they think that they've been attacked, when there's a cyber attack. So the insurance company wouldn't want to let down the customer too much and affect its reputation, but they also don't want to be spending so much on investigation. So this leads to the possibility of an all-perils approach. And this might, in the future, result in there being policies that cover a lot more things so that instead of having to spend money necessarily on investigation, there will just be coverage regardless, and that will reduce the effect of this swamping investigation cost. So here we've got a breakdown of claims cost by heads of damage, and this is from 2010 to 2015. And you can see the purple one there is investigation, and it's a huge part of the cost from an insurance perspective. And lost business is also a very big part, and the others are relatively small. All right, so reserving, what we all love. The initial challenges are that there are no standard policy coverage and limitations at the moment. So many of the policies out there are taken from insurers' counterparts in the US and adapted to Australia, but there aren't any standard policy coverages. Another challenge is the best data is out of date. So as I mentioned before, the landscape is changing, threats are changing. It's very difficult to even know whether or not the data is useful for reserving. So the third issue is about the conflicts with other policies, and that has to do with the possibility of there being an all perils kind of coverage in the future. But there is hope for reserving. There are ways to do it regardless of all of these issues. And one thing that we can do is we can learn from other classes that have similar characteristics. So PI and MedMal, they are similar from one respect in that MedMal you have to prove causation, and that's very similar in cyber. D&O has some similarities as well, and maybe the main one that's useful there is that it underwent very large changes in relation to the legal framework and precedents that were out there, and the wordings of the policies were changed over time. So there's quite a lot to learn from other kinds of policies. Okay, so what do we know about reserving that could be used? The first thing is that in one of the surveys that has reasonably good data, which is called the Poneman survey of this year, they found that the average time between the actual breach and reporting the breach was around half a year. So this means that there's been a virus sitting on a computer on average for half a year before a company actually reports it to an insurer. So this should ring alarm bells for IBNR estimates, and also has a big impact on whether or not the policy is claims made or claims incurred. Now, the second thing to note for reserving is that first-party heads of damage are relatively easy to estimate. So these are things like business interruption, crisis management, repairing the actual systems, and, for example, cyber extortion. So if you have ransomware on your computer and it locks your computer until you pay a certain amount of money, well, that's easy to estimate what the reserve needs to be for that because it says how much money needs to be paid. But third-party heads of damage are much more difficult to estimate. So this is like legal costs and costs of indemnifying third parties for lost data. The other thing to note is that regulatory penalties are going to evolve over time. So the reserving methodology, it seems like it will be very, very simple to begin with, probably a case estimate with the help of IT experts, plus some IBNR that maybe uses a loss ratio times and like an unearned amount of premium. Another big question mark in reserving is that the risk margins could hypothetically make up a very big portion of the actual reserve. So the uncertainty in these estimates are so high, partially because of the regular process uncertainty and parameter uncertainty and so on, but also because of the possibility of large horizontal accumulations. And this is that an insurer might cover many different industries, but each of these industries might be infected by the same computer virus. So this raises the possibility of there being very big correlations and high risk margins. Finally, on reserving is a warning. So as an example, if a hospital gets hacked and they lose 100 of their patients' data, and then it ends up costing them, let's say, $1 million to indemnify these people, well, that can be equated to $10,000 per record lost. And then this is often reported in the cyber surveys. It says cost per record lost $10,000 or $8,000. But recent studies have shown that we link it there at the bottom. Recent studies show that this number is actually not constant. So as the number of records lost increases, it seems to turn out that the cost per record actually goes down. So this is just a warning that if you are going to be doing reserving, don't look at the surveys and just pick the cost per record and multiply it by the number of records, because that won't be right. Right, I'll pass back to Peter.
Thanks, Dean. Dean's already touched on correlation between industries, and I want to pick up that thread. So, as we've said, there's not a lot of data out there. So when it comes to correlations between industries and aggregation scenarios, we're not going to be building a CAT-style model like you do for quakes, like you do for wind. There just simply isn't the information out there. What there are is some scenarios of varying qualities. We've got a list up there. I'm going to touch on a couple of those. And you can play with the parameters, you can play with the assumptions and give yourself a bit of a distribution around that to kind of start to get a bit of a feel. But the real value of these is actually the process of working through the scenarios. I want to talk about the top two there, which are electricity grid scenarios. Data sources are at the bottom. A bunch of these towards the bottom there are from RMS. They appear to be at the moment high-level descriptions of scenarios. They're very useful descriptions, they're very useful scenarios, but there's not a lot of sort of quantitative meat behind them as far as we know at this stage. So the vendors are in the early days. Probably the highest quality scenario that's out there at the moment is built by Cambridge Centre for Risk Studies for Lloyd's of London. It considers a breach of a cyber attack on the northeast US electricity grid, which results in substantial downtime. They put return periods on it and quantify the losses, and they work them through in quite a detailed way. So if you're thinking about cyber aggregations, this is the paper to go and pick up, and go to Appendix 1 first. Read Appendix 1. It gives you the meat. Why have they chosen electricity grids? There are a couple of reasons. So electricity grids have a nasty habit of failing collectively because they're all linked up. The regulators are very interested in this sort of failure, and there's a long history of loss events because everyone knows when the electricity grid goes down. It's quite well recorded. So there are, in the US and Australia and the UK, et cetera, there's a lot of information on this around loss extent, around return period, not necessarily insured loss. We also have the element that this is a fairly credible threat. So in 2015, the Ukraine had a cyber attack on their electricity grid. There have been examples of laboratory demonstrations of destruction of electrical machinery as a result of cyber attacks. The last element to take away from these electricity grid attacks is the issue of proximate cause. So the original attack might have been a cyber peril, but just because you've written a property cover doesn't mean to say you're immune from it. You're likely to have to respond. That's the key takeaway from the US Northeast Grid scenario. Whether you've written D&O, property, whatever, They're all on the list of policies expected by Lloyd's to respond. Okay, so we've been through this very, very quickly. No apologies. There's a lot of material to cover. As Dean said, there's some more stuff in the appendix for you, and lots of footnotes for you to follow up in a particular area if your boss comes and asks you about it. So let's talk really quickly about the future. So what's the future in Australia? Why are we doing all this work? You know, mandatory reporting of data breaches is on its way. There's likely to be a corresponding tightening of privacy laws, both the actual laws, the enforcement by the regulators, and public expectation. We're just following on from what's happening in other countries. Evolution of cyber threats. So amateur hackers are picking up releases of professional hackers' tools, and suddenly amateur hackers can launch some very, very devastating attacks. So there've been very, very bad denial of service attacks recently. And Australia's having more high-profile data breaches, and the profile is an important factor here in terms of selling insurance. As a result of these, we're going to see more take-up in cyber insurance as a result of awareness, as a result of demand. We're also likely to see a streamlining of cyber products across the different products. So the products are more similar. The products are better aligned with an insurer's suite. So if you're buying a cyber cover as part of a business package, over time we should expect them to dovetail better across the package. And the one thing that's kind of a little bit implicit in this whole presentation is up till now, and probably still for some time, we're going to see cyber insurance focusing on data breaches. We're starting to see little elements of cyber insurance responding to other types of cyber perils. So in Australia, with a good example is ransomware. So that's another element that's going to come through in the fullness of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter and... Thank you, Peter and Dean. That was great. If anyone's got any questions, please come up to the microphone over there and ask them. Shall I?
So I've got a question about cyber insurance in context of individuals. So we've talked a lot about... you know, the take-up rate for, you know, SME policies and large corporations. But what about, like, just individuals like you and I or, you know, celebrities who, you know, might have their whatever Twitter or whatever, you know, social media type of account being attacked and obviously their image tarnished in some sort of fashion. So is that a future that we need to consider as well?
I think the product at the moment and the development of the product's focused and been driven very heavily by... losses of third-party data. So to the extent that individuals don't, most individuals don't hold a lot of third-party data unless they're running some sort of business, either as a sole trader or under a proper sort of legal structure, it's probably not going to be a high priority. What we might see is sort of elements of along the lines of public liability thrown in as a sort of more of an advertising or a promotional or an awareness-raising item, but there's not the same sort of not the same sort of quantity of personal data that most people hold at the moment.
So on that, I mean, given recent events, Red Cross, etc., I mean, should people be changing behaviours? Would you still give blood? Are you cancelling your Ashley Madison account?
Never.
Have I cancelled my Ashley Madison account? That's a bit like the question of have I stopped beating my wife yet? No. In all seriousness, no. I mean, this is the world we live in. Our data is out there. I think that's. I've had two emails from Have I Been Pawned Yet? Website which notifies you if your email address has popped up on data breaches. This is something that's going to continue to happen to all of us on a regular basis. This is information that we put out there as a cost of doing business, of facilitating the services that are provided to us. We can't completely go into our shells and not engage.
I've been a lot more careful recently, where I'm much more conscious of whether or not the apps that I'm using have end-to-end encryption. And a few of the apps these days are starting to add that, which means that they don't keep your data on their server in an unencrypted way. So I think that's starting to pick up a bit, and I'm definitely much more conscious of that. Like, in my note-taking app, I want it to be end-to-end encrypted so that it's not on their server. So maybe people will be more careful with that.
How likely is an attack on the Australian power grid?
So I think there's two parts to that. One is the likelihood of the attack, and the second part is would it be successful? The likelihood in part depends on motivation of people to attack and availability of tools. So whenever Australia is involved in some sort of high-profile disagreement or conflict, that raises the possibility that someone will be motivated to do that. At the moment, there don't seem to be tools out there specifically designed for that which have make it easy for people to do it. The flip side is, as we saw recently in South Australia, the Australian grid is connected between the states by a very small number of links. And the nature of that in the southeast, at least, makes it very vulnerable to things going wrong and disrupting those links and bringing large parts of the network down.
Go ahead.
Jenny Lyon, I'm just interested in the actual wording in some of these policies in terms of how you actually know what you're covered for. And I'm thinking about, example I'm thinking about is a superannuation fund or superannuation policy. So where there's significant data, that if it was lost, what kind of cover's offered? And also, whether you think insurers might ultimately look at the way that organisations protect their data in terms of perhaps, you know, regularly hacking into their own data to see what the risks are and whether that might form part of policy conditions in the future.
So start with the second part first. So at the moment, I think insurers are struggling to apply some sort of unified way of looking at the security precautions that insureds are taking. They're not sort of penetration testing, for example. They're not sort of standardised ways of doing this, not sort of standardised benchmarks you can compare across different insureds. And so everyone's sort of struggling with that and also struggling with underwriting it in a proportionate manner. So without spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars doing the underwriting. On the first part, in terms of cover, so the coverage is around so crisis management, immediate response, forensics around getting to the root of what's actually happened, because it can often be quite difficult figuring out what's actually gone. So as far as from a Red Cross point of view, they don't know whether anyone actually took the data. They just know it was exposed, and so that's part of the, and that feeds into the PR. And the engagement with the regulators and potentially any regulatory fines, depending on local legislation, to cover those. And part of it's also services. So with your car, if something goes wrong with your car, you've got a degree of familiarity about what happens, the same around your house. Cyber breaches, cyber attacks, it's pretty much always going to be new for the next few years. It's going to be new to everyone involved. So there's a service element there, which is they kind of hold your hand through the process or bring in third parties to do that.
Okay, so if there's no further questions, that was ensuring cyber risk. Could you please help me thank PD8 and Dean Marcus?